So welcome. It's good to see each one of you, and particularly good to welcome you, David. Some of you may recall, not Paul Harland, obviously, you can't remember when Freud was born, but some of you may recall that David King was a minister in Lougheed's cabinet for quite a number of years, and I recall at least on the street, I suppose this is an old story, on the street he was often referred to as the philosopher king in the Lougheed cabinet. And my memory is that it was an appropriate thing to call him, because it's not always the case that we have someone serving at that level in our government who can actually hold two ideas together at the same time. It's not unknown, but it's not always. And even when I found myself arguing with you in my mind, it was a worthy argument. So I'm delighted you're here with us. David King is now the executive director of the Public School Boards Association of Alberta, and remained very active in public life and in thinking about these demanding issues, particularly associated with education and how we are shaping things, what the impact of that is on the generations that are coming to be citizens of our world. We hadn't really talked or crossed paths for a number of years, but David did call me, and we sat down and talked together about Bill 44, which I think I was surprised at the time it didn't have far more debate, and because the implications seem enormous. So I'm really looking forward to your speaking with us and to us talking together. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, David. And thank you for the invitation to be here. What you're going to discover this evening is that if I am the philosopher king, philosophy is pretty thin at the beginning of the 21st century in Alberta. But I really do appreciate the opportunity to be with you this evening. I'd like to make some introductory remarks, and then I'd like us to have a conversation. And in the conversation, I expect that I will learn more from you than you will learn from me. But that's what I get for driving 80 kilometers down the road. I should get more. Let me begin by giving you a little bit more background than David did. I'm a preacher's kid. My father was a United Church minister, and my grandfather was. And back in those days, if your father and your grandfather were clergy, it was quite likely that you had aunts and uncles and cousins who were clergy as well, and I did. We came from a family of clergy. And I grew up with faith convictions that have been important to me all of my life, and some of them more important in the context of politics and civil life than others were. Maybe I shouldn't separate them, but for the purposes of our conversation this evening, I'd mention three. I'm a believer in free will. I am a believer that God leaves it to us to make choices, and that we have the responsibility for the choices that we make. My father and my grandfather often said to my brother, my sisters, and me as we were growing up, that we are partners with God in the act of creation. we had responsibility. We have responsibility to continue the work of creation, not under any illusions that we were going to do a better job of finishing God's work than he had done, but that we had obligations. Thirdly, that we are people of shalom. I've never studied languages, Greek, Aramaic, Latin. I just have the understanding of that I took from my parents and from others. We are people of peace, people of wholeness. And that the kingdom of God is among us. It is not something out there in the future, but that it is with us now. And I also grew up with something that in the United Church and in other denominations, I'm sure, was called the social gospel. It came from the University of Chicago Theology School, I understand. I can remember hearing the name Walter Rauschenbusch when I was a child, although I've never read him. My knowledge of the social gospel comes from my father and my grandfather. My grandfather ran for the CCF in a New Brunswick by-election in 1944, and my father worked his way through undergraduate studies at university as an organizer for the CCF. So I just grew up with this very much a part of my life. The equally important thing to say is that I was a teenager in the very last years of the 50s and the early years of the 60s. And for all I grew up in this family that I have just described to you, I also, part of me, I think, wanted to fit in for whatever reason. I covertly absorbed the culture of competition that was so dominant at that time. I could sometimes be very competitive, sometimes very combative. My wife says simply stubborn, but wives tend to have a different outlook on things. And there's just no doubt about it that I absorbed some of that, and it too has influenced me all through my life. David said that I was involved with the Progressive Conservative Party, and that came to me very early. When I was in high school, I wanted to be Prime Minister of Canada, and when I came to the University of Alberta, I met Peter Lougheed about 5 months after he had been elected leader of the provincial party, before he had a seat in the legislature. I met him on the University of Alberta campus and quickly became involved with the Progressive Conservative Party. 1967, when he was elected leader of the opposition, I went to work for him in the legislature building. So I was his research assistant for 2 years, during which time I married. I went back to university and left Peter's office to work part-time for the Edmonton and District Council of Churches while I was finishing off my university. So I spent a couple of years as research director for the Edmonton and District Council of Churches at a time when there were some notable people involved in the council. Ed Checkland, who was the minister at First Baptist Church downtown, Harry Meadows, who was the minister at McDougall United, Ed Kennedy, who was a Roman Catholic priest, George McClellan, who was the ombudsman for the province at that time. So my paths crossed with these people in the Council of Churches. And in 71, I was elected to the legislature, which was the year the Progressive Conservatives formed the government. So I am a living manifestation of the last time the government changed in this province. the government, I am somewhat the worse for wear. I was 15 years an MLA, 7 years a cabinet minister, almost all of that as Minister of Education. But I did have some involvement with federal politics, and I see that Flora is coming to the campus on Friday evening. And if I didn't have a prior commitment, I'd drive down here again.
Actually, she'll be at King's in Edmonton on Friday evening.
I will be in Red Deer. And I remember
maybe
we'll now
change the venues for
you. I would appreciate it. I would love to hear. I would love to hear Flora. In my time as a cabinet minister, I had a reputation as a maverick or a free spirit. My arguments were quite often unsuccessful in caucus or in cabinet. I have voted against the government on division on some of their legislation when I was a backbench MLA. And when I was a minister, I floated many a trial balloon, and they were often simply let go to drift away, never to be seen or heard from again. But out of all of that, in my family and in those early political activities, I was nurtured in what I often characterize as the politics of hope, respect, inclusion, community, and collaboration. And all of those ideas is very, very important to me. Hope, respect, inclusion, community, and collaboration. I lost an election in 1986, and so was then watching somewhat from the sidelines, although I continued to be involved with the party. And in 1993-95, shortly after Mr. Klein became leader of the party, I really saw many things change, and dramatically, in the Progressive Conservative Party, and certainly unhappily from my point of view. As far as I was concerned, the politics of hope was replaced by the politics of fear, and respect was replaced by intimidation, and inclusion was replaced by exclusion, and community was replaced by selfishness, and collaboration was replaced by bullying. And I really didn't like it. I was angry. And I would say that I stayed angry for about 15 years. For 10 years, I didn't belong to any party from 94 until 2004. And I would say that from 93 or 94, for 15 years, I was an angry person, which is not a good state to be in. I, even then, even in the midst of it, I sometimes felt as though I was rationalizing my anger with simple-minded references to the stern judges or the angry prophets of the Old Testament, or Christ in the temple with the money changers and the sacrifice vendors, that competitiveness that I had absorbed when I was in high school really reared its head during those 15 years. I was determined to beat the government party at its own game. I was determined to help some contending party become more competitive vis-a-vis the Progressive Conservative Party. I'd put 29 years into that party, and I was disappointed, and I was angry, as I say. And as you can imagine, through all of those 15 years, anger got me nowhere, and an increased focus on competition got me nowhere. But being sometimes a slow learner, it took me the better part of 15 years to figure that out. I had to think more and more about the judges and the prophets and Christ. And I would say that very slowly, because maybe through those years I was more preoccupied with politics than I was with faith, maybe because of my anger, who knows. But I had to start thinking again about the presence of the kingdom of God and what my parents and my grandparents had tried to instill in me 40 or 50 years ago. What some others had tried to instill in me. You come back slowly to thinking that as a Christian, it is my role to be in the world, but not of the world. And slowly, I come to realize that in my faith, and it is interesting in my politics, what I want to do is not to buy into the model that is there, and on the other hand, not to contend with the model that is there. I don't live in the house built on sand, and at the same time, if somebody else has built that house of sand, it isn't my job to try to destroy it. It is simply my job to build my house on the rock that I can find and inhabit my house and offer my house as an alternative to people for whom living in the house built on sand is not satisfactory. And so I try to come back to that now in my faith and in my politics. David and I talked about this first
more than a year ago,
15 months ago. And since then, a couple of months ago, I actually retired as executive director of the Public School Boards Association. So I'm not anyone's employee anymore. And on the other hand, I'm now back to being involved with a political party. And one of the things that I am saying in that political party is that it's not our responsibility to try to be a better model of what is there. And it's not our responsibility to try to beat the other party or the other parties. It is our responsibility to be a different and, I hope, a better and a stronger model, and just to be there for the people who want to come to something that I would say is closer to being built on rock rather than sand. But I'm not going to import the parable. I'm not going to export it from the Bible and import it to political life. That might be a little bit unseemly. So what I am trying to do now, personally and in my political engagement, is to remember for myself, maybe say to others, that my responsibility is not to contend against the circumstances that are created by institutions of this world, but just to try to offer alternatives that people could go to, faith alternatives, life alternatives, or political alternatives. I think that we need to We need to remember that we are people of faith and people of grace. We need to remember that our responsibility is to include, most particularly it's our responsibility to include when it is difficult to include, our responsibility is to collaborate with people. Our responsibility is to respect people, and our responsibility is to live in community, whether it's a civil community or a faith community. Our responsibility is not to contend with the world as it is, but to offer people, to whatever extent we can, the kingdom of God in us and around us wherever we live and work in the world. The question I might end with is, practically speaking, what does that mean for each of us? I doubt very much that I am a philosopher, in spite of the fact that some people did that to tweak me, said that to tweak me a little bit. But I am a student. I'm not much of an academic student, but I do like to move around in the world and watch people doing things and ask questions and sometimes sit in silence in the presence of other people. I think that the world is preoccupied with each of us seeking validation outside of ourselves. What do others think of us? How much money have we amassed? How much land do we have? The list goes on. I think we have to try to encourage people to look inside themselves for validation. Not that it is a part of the physical being that is inside them, but the presence of God is inside us. And I think we have to look for our validation in the presence of God that is within us, rather than the money or the fame or the, however we count, the toys. We need to shift, I think, from being self-absorbed. And I know that more often than I am. We need to be absorbed by the presence of a transcendent spirit. God makes us more than we are because God makes us part of himself every moment, every place, whether we're aware of it or not. I think we need faith that seeks harmony with the kingdom of God, and that dissents from the world, not so much by contending with it and competing with it, but by assenting to the New Jerusalem. That we live the presence of a better alternative rather than fighting with what is. Now, when we talked about this 15 months ago, we talked about Guy Boutelier crossing the floor, we talked about Bill 44, we talked about big communities and small communities and communities that feel isolated from others. All of those I would be glad to talk about, but in 15 months, other events have perhaps come to loom larger in our mind than those. We can talk about anything, but I would like it to be a conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you. That's a fairly substantial opening. So it's good to hear you on this. One of the when we did talk, if I can sort of open this up, and in light of what you have said, you expressed serious concerns about Bill 44.
Yes.
Connect the dots around that for us a little bit, given what you said. The whole notion of exclusion and inclusion. And also some attention to the question of the formation of the young.
Yeah. The thing that concerns me about Bill 44, and let me begin by saying that I offer these comments about Alberta because this is where all of us live. I have some interest in politics in other jurisdictions. I spend some time in BC. And I would say that the things that concern me really are institutional. They're culturally institutional. They're not party institutional. I think that a Liberal government in BC might just as easily adopt a Bill 44 as this government in Alberta, or that an NDP government in Manitoba might just as easily adopt it as here, especially perhaps if it's been the government for a long, long time. The thing that concerns me is that governments are increasingly promoting fear, because it seems to be a fairly simple and straightforward way of promoting themselves as a reliable protector of us against fear. So we are told that we need a firewall and we should be afraid of everything east of Saskatchewan, or we're told that we should be afraid of Toronto because they're overwhelmingly larger than Alberta. About 7 million people in a metropolitan area as compared with 3.5 million in the province. Or we're told that we should be afraid that we cannot provide health care for ourselves in years to come. And I don't mean to be a defense of our health care system, but we hear... not the word, but the tone of fear in so many messages. We should be afraid of refugees. We should be afraid of what Muslims are doing in Afghanistan or in Iraq. To me, Bill 44 embodied fear, among other things. And one of the outcomes of fear is that we withdraw into smaller and smaller and more protected communities. I often think of gated communities as being representative of fear. Let's go somewhere where everybody is like us. Everybody's got the same vocational background, either from the Midwestern United States or from the prairies of Canada. Let's have a guardhouse. Let's play golf together and never leave the community to play golf. And the list goes on. In Christianity and certainly in other religions, you've got millennialist fear. I believe in God. And I trust that at some time the end of this is going to be the kingdom of heaven. And in the meantime, I trust that God is with me every moment of my journey along the way. I don't have time for the politics of fear. And if you had no faith whatsoever, no Christian faith, I still think of it as being corrosive. It eats away at our community. It undermines respect. It undermines inclusion. It undermines community, and it undermines collaboration. So I saw Bill 44 as being, first of all, a manifestation of fear. And what really bothered me was that it projected that fear right through the adult community into our children. Not directly into our children, but into us as their nurturers. It seemed to me that it provoked us to be fearful not only for ourselves, but for our children. It was a matter of education, and I need to speak a little bit about education. I spent 7 years as minister, and you leave that. I was enthusiastic about it. I enjoyed it. If you talk to people who were involved in it at that time, I went anywhere and everywhere. I got so much out of being minister. You leave the ministry, you think you know all about education. And then 4 years later, I went to work for public school boards across the province, which I did for 20 years. And I'm constantly struck by how much I learned about education working for trustees that I never learned while I was Minister of Education, that I did not know after 7 years. One of those things is that I believe profoundly for strong communities that we need to educate little Catholic kids beside little Protestant kids, beside little Indian kids, beside little refugee kids, beside rich kids, beside kids who speak no English. And it is a very difficult thing to do. It's a very, very difficult thing to do well. But it is just profoundly important. I remember visiting once with a teacher in Edmonton who told me that she had a little boy older than he should be for grade 6, but he was in grade 6. He was a Somali refugee, okay? And 18 months before that, he had been carrying an AK-47. Okay? He had been a child soldier. Okay? He may have, should we say, probably had killed people at the age of 11, okay? Illiterate in English, angry, confused, older than he should be in grade 6, and he was in her classroom. Okay? And somehow or another, she and other people were making it work. Okay? This is an incredible challenge. You know, you could say the same thing about the teacher who's got an autistic child in the class, and the list goes on. We make our community work through education. And it bothers me greatly that as part of our adult condition of fear, we're going to withdraw from the community and take our children with us and insist that on all occasions, in respect of all issues, they should hear only what we want them to hear. Now, the other side of that is that I would be the first to accept that the school should be more connected to the community than it is, and it is sometimes not nearly connected enough. But the answer to either concern is not to start fragmenting our school and fragment our community? Okay. The answer is, in my view, we put our shoulder to the wheel and we make our community work. I read a book about a decade ago by a man in Montana named Daniel Kemmes, Community in the Politics of Place. It's a great community, a great book. And he talks about growing up on a big ranch on the eastern plains of Montana. When he was about 8 years old, the family across the road lost their big barn. And he knew that his parents didn't approve of the family across the road. His parents were Rock Rib Presbyterians. Go to church twice on Sunday, take your kids with you, and send your kids a third time to Sunday school. Okay? Do not smoke, do not drink, do not cuss, none of that. Okay? And the family across the road was pretty much the opposite. Okay, there's where the kids who would take your kids out behind the barn and tell them the facts of life at whatever age. But the barn across the road burned down. And his mother and father were on the phone immediately, organizing the men for a barn raising and organizing the women to bring food, take care of the kids, and everything else. At the age of 8, he asked his parents why they were investing so much in the future of the family across the road, because you often, you know, look askance at the people across the road. And his father was pretty stern and said to him, "We are a community. Okay? And if my barn burned down, he'd be doing the same thing for me." That's true in a civil community, and it is equally true in a faith community. Okay? I go to a church. There are people that I love there. I've been going there since I was 8 years old, since my father was called to that church. Okay? There are some people there who really rub me the wrong way every time I am in their company. Okay? But that, I think, is me more than anything else, because they have gifts. Okay? Not what I think of as gifts, okay, but I know that they have touched the lives of other people in the congregation in ways that wouldn't have touched me, but were very, very meaningful for other people. Civil community, faith community, we are all in this together. And 44 was just, first of all, fear. Secondly, it was blind ideology. There was absolutely no evidence that large numbers of people approved of it, had any interest in it. It was driven by a very small number of people, because the government itself is not reaching out and listening to people. One of the most important lessons I learned from Peter Lougheed was, if you are a politician, never start the conversation with a statement. Okay. Never open a conversation with anybody by telling them what the government is doing or what great things there are or whatever else. Start the conversation by asking the person, okay, what's hurting you? What are you looking forward to? That's mine, so excuse me for a moment while I turn it off. Okay. You know, you can see when a government goes out into the world with its own statements for people, rather than asking people, you know, what's the life of this community? What's hurting you? What are you looking forward to? So fear, small-mindedness ideology, starting with the government's position rather than the public's position, ignorance of our circumstances. The fact of the matter is that the Constitution of Alberta currently allows parents
to
withdraw their kids from school wherever there is religious instruction or exercise. So it seemed not to be a good thing.
Did you have, I mean, you obviously tried talking with a number of politicians around this.
Yeah.
How did that go?
It didn't go well.
Did you speak to them about the fear card? Did you push
them
with them?
To three or four of them that I knew would be receptive to it. But at a certain point, caucus cohesion kicks in. It's very interesting. Most of us around this room, there are a couple of notable exceptions, but most of us could remember Diefenbaker, you know, or Lester B. Pearson. 30 or 40 years ago, the Prime Minister, the leader of government, was truly called the first among equals. But you knew that in every cabinet there were three or four equals. There were people who were intelligent, tough, well-respected, thoughtful, and their leaving could bring down a government. Okay? Diefenbaker was brought down by Doug Harkness, you know, who was Minister of Defense. Trudeau had Pelletier, Marchand, and Lalonde. Peter had Merv Leach or Neil Crawford. Caucus cohesion and party discipline has made great strides in Canada in the last 30 years. We have far more discipline in our party system than exists in the United Kingdom or Australia or New Zealand or India. There's a club of parliamentarians called the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. These people get together from all over the world once or twice a year. And elected representatives from any other country are astonished at how much party discipline there is, federally and provincially, all across the country. Because within Canada, we talk to each other. And if the Premier of BC has done something to exert a little bit more influence over his caucus, the Premier of Alberta picks that up, and the Premier of Saskatchewan picks it up, and it goes across the country. So it's not surprising that within the country we're all of a kind. But almost everywhere else in the world, in the British Commonwealth, people talk about levels of discipline. They talk about a one-line whip or a two-line whip or a three-line whip. We don't even know that term in Canada, because in Canada we apply the three-line whip all the time. You vote against the government and you are out. Okay? And now we've gone past you vote against the government, you're out. You speak and you're out. Guy Boutelier didn't even speak against the government. He only tried to stand up to advocate the interests of his constituency. The first two times I was nominated, before the 71 and the 75 election, my nomination by people in the constituency was the end of it. The leader of the party had nothing to say about it. Okay? If the people in the constituency chose a terrible, terrible person who had a bad background that was going to be revealed on the front pages of the Edmonton Journal tomorrow, the people of the constituency were responsible for that, and they were responsible for fixing it. In 78, 77, 78, in an effort to make this system more democratic, we brought in the Election Finances and Contributions Disclosure Act, which on the whole did good things, I would say. But one of the things that we did, giving no thought to the implications of it, was that we required that the leader of the party had to sign off on the nomination. Okay, that's true for the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, the NDP, the Wild Rose Alliance, and party leaders love it.
It's a transfer of power.
Exactly, because what it means now is that many constituency associations in many parties have de facto abdicated the responsibility for choosing their candidate to the central organization of the party, because they know the party, as soon as a name comes up in Camrose, the provincial association is going to vet it. They're going to look for background. They're going to look for, you know, whatever. And they may well say, this is the candidate that we would like to see win the nomination. If that candidate is nominated, the leader will not sign his or her papers. Okay? So what has happened is the responsibility of constituency associations has been gutted insofar as the choice of a candidate for MLA is concerned. That has been moved to the provincial party leader. And David Swan likes that as much as Ed Stelmach does. You know, Brian Mason likes that as much as Ed Stelmach does. So you've got common cloth across all the parties. Okay? They've all, at the constituency level, they've all substantially abdicated. Now, the abdication is more substantial with the government party, because that's the person who is more likely to win, and they've got the greater vested interest. You get to an NDP constituency where they've never ever won the seat, the central party may not care who is the candidate in that constituency. But wherever there is a felt need, you see this happen. The same is true of discipline. And so we've got an incredibly disciplined system now, where the caucus defers to what the premier wants, or what the premier wants three or four people to have in order that he can get something from them on another day. I don't think that Mr. Stelmach wanted Bill 44 particularly, but he had three MLAs who did. Okay, and I think that it was a matter of, you stroke my back, I'll stroke your back.
So the rest of you. You were saying you wanted to move beyond contending with, you know, the political parties or whatever, and live an alternative. So what do you do when a Bill 44 appears? Do you not sort of contend or struggle with trying to overcome it, or any other crappy policies that are coming down the pipe?
I think that you do, and maybe I am only describing a mood change for myself. Maybe it's just that I'm past being angry. You do have to speak out against Bill 44. I did personally. That was 18 months ago. And I did through the association that I worked for when I was their agent in speaking to MLAs about it. So yes, you do. But I found it more a matter of speaking the truth simply because it was the truth to be spoken, and not because I had to invest anything in ensuring that the truth succeed in that situation. I think that if Bill 44 had come up 6 or 7 years earlier than it did, when I was in this angry phase, I think I'd have gone beyond speaking to MLAs and speaking to other organizations, which I did. And I think I would have engaged in some angry practices, which wouldn't have helped me personally and wouldn't have helped the argument about Bill 44. So I find myself, I have not changed in my felt need to speak about some of these things, but I'm not emotionally invested in that dissent. I would prefer to make my emotional investment in an alternative assent. Does that, do you follow that?
The difference between being critical of something and contending with it.
Yes.
Doing yes. the battle and getting
yes,
wrapped
that,
in the battle.
That's very much it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, in Mexico, the phrase, you know, whatever, most people who, you know, both within and outside of the church, but let's say the district communities or the social movements, is it's a lucha continua, so it's an ongoing struggle. You know, so in a certain sense, one is struggling. But yeah, you know, so I, you know, it's hard to. You know, I see what you're saying. You're saying, okay, well, I'll speak sort of, you know, truth to power or whatever, yeah. and I won't become nasty to score points or whatever. If that's what contending would mean. But what's the difference between struggling and contending? Because if you don't struggle for democracy, if you don't struggle for inclusion, if you don't struggle for collaboration, it also won't happen, right? I mean, you can't inherit democracy. You have to work for it or struggle for it.
No, that's right. And let me use, as an example, my current involvement in a political party, okay, that very few of you have ever heard of. It's called the Alberta Party. Most of the people involved in it are 20 years younger than I am. You know, I'm getting close to being an elder statesman. I can barely believe this. But I look at parties, the ones that we are experienced with, and I say that I observe that they all rely on the model of the ultimate leader, the charismatic leader. Okay, we choose Peter Lougheed, and we put most of the burden on his shoulders, and we think of him as being charismatic. When he retires, we do that with Don Getty, and we discover after 3 or 4 years that Don Getty is not charismatic. Okay,
some sooner.
And that's right, some sooner, and so we get rid of him. And we choose Ralph Klein, and eventually he retires, and we choose Ed Stelmach. And now the question is Ed Stelmach a charismatic leader? The others do the same. The Liberals got rid of Kevin Taft because he was not charismatic, and chose David Swan in the hope that he was, and are frustrated that he isn't, so should they get rid of him? Brian Mason the same. When the Wild Rose Alliance wants to contend with these parties, it chooses a charismatic leader. Okay? So what happens is that what I call the DNA of the party actually changes substantially every time the party changes, okay? Because the party adopts the coloration, or it adopts the DNA of the new leader. Ralph Klein had no problem saying of Don Getty, that was then, this is now. No matter what they did, I, Ralph Klein, am not responsible for it. Love me for myself. You know, who cares about the past? What would happen if you started something with a determination that collectively people were going to generate a DNA, okay? And when the DNA was distributed throughout the party, right, the party then would choose a leader who was reflective of the party as a whole, rather than be a blank slate until you choose a leader and then adopt the coloration of the leader. Okay? So if you come back to the Mexican phrase, which I will try to remember, okay, I would say that if we are thinking of our faith life or our political life, and in my view there shouldn't be any separation between them, okay, What we want to try to do is not so much contend with political parties or with conditions as live and offer an alternative that people can come to. In party, we will try to create a party that doesn't rely on a charismatic leader. We will try to create a party where there is leadership widely distributed throughout the party. Now, I use this only as an illustration. It may or may not happen, but my argument would be that we don't want to contend with the progressive conservatives by finding a more charismatic leader, okay, and beating them in the context of that model. What we would like to do is contend with what we propose, let people choose. That's the role of the Christian in life. We're not nearly so successful proselytizing as we are leading a Christian life. My favorite Aesop story is probably about the sun and the north wind having a bet about who will get the cloak off the traveler more quickly. Okay? And the north wind goes first and blows harder and harder, fiercer and fiercer, and the traveler just holds on to the cloak more and more tightly. When it's the sun's turn, the sun just beats down gently, and the traveler drops the cloak on the road. Okay? Examples everywhere and every time. We didn't convert the Middle East with the Crusades. To be God's kingdom in this world is, I think you have to say Bill 44 is wrong, okay? But you don't have to put more of your emotional energy than that into it. After that, you've got to go with others to a different place. And whether it's your local school or your local church or your local political party or wherever, you have to offer people the alternative that they are attracted to.
You offer them a vision which isn't the fear.
Which isn't?
The fear.
Exactly. No, that's right.
So it changes the terms of reference.
Yes.
Our own.
I would maybe just mention my own experience. I took over the New Sarepta High School in 1975. And just after, and it was known as the sinkhole of the county.
Yep.
It was a bad school. And it was a bad school.
Yep.
And just at that time, the community school idea came up. So I went to the community and said, look, you're all unhappy with the school, right?
Yep.
Okay. We're not happy either. So let's collaborate,
yep,
work together to make a better school, which is basically what we did. And one of the things I took particular care about, we had there's a church in New Sarepta called the Zion Evangelical Church. It's a very fundamentalist church. And I actually had, once a month, I had lunch with their pastor. I'm a Lutheran.
Yes.
And, but just to make sure that they were included. And then we had a study on, they brought in human sexuality as a part of the family life education.
Yes.
And they were very much against it at the beginning, but I did persuade the pastor to be vice chair of the committee that studied it. And they said, okay, we'll go ahead with it. And we had all of the things laid out, and all the kids in that church and all the parents in that church supported the program. So I think this is the alternative vision. We are a community, the school, in my view, what we were trying to do was to embed it in the community. And then the other thing that we did, which we never talked about, is we created a culture of caring. in the school.
Like, yeah.
I cared about the teachers and the parents. The teachers cared about the kids. You get that. And then what happened is most of your discipline problems just disappeared. It was quite incredible.
And were you there in 79?
Yep.
So you were one of the very first designated community schools in the
program. We were right near the beginning.
Yeah, that's right.
And Ryan Staples came out and helped us through the whole process.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that shows that you can, you know, wherever you are, you can sort of do these things. You just have to have a sort of galvanize everybody and be inclusive. I wanted to make sure everybody was involved. The only people actually that stayed out of the program, like the family sexual life program, were the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
Everybody else was in. So you can do these things, and that's just in your own little sphere, try to make a difference.
Yeah.
And it was in the end, it was based on the we have to have compassion and care for one another. I mean, that was the underlying thing that we never talked about, but it was there all the way through. And everybody bought into that kind of way of doing things and being open. Like, one year we had 120 people come and volunteer at the school, at the high school. That's the high school.
The word...
So we had a lot of... So it, those kind of things work.
Yes, they do. The word that I almost always use is hope. Okay, the politics of hope or the politics of fear. For me personally, it is a politics of faith. Okay, there was a man named Viktor Frankl who was a preteen in a Holocaust camp during the Second World War. And he wasn't very big and wasn't very strong, but he survived to the end of the Second World War. Went on to become a very famous psychologist. And he wrote later that the roots of his fame as a psychologist lay in trying to figure out why he had survived the Holocaust experience as a preteen in the Second World War when others were bigger and stronger and whatever. And he said he eventually concluded that in everything that happens to us, there is the smallest split second between the action by a Gestapo guard or anybody else, our employer or our wife or our son or our daughter, doesn't matter who it is, and our response to it. Okay? And he concluded that the people who lived through the Holocaust experience tended to be the people who would make a decision to respond in hope. Okay? If a guard kicked you, okay, you might say, I'm glad he didn't use the butt of his rifle on me. You know, if he just lashed out at you verbally, I'm glad that he didn't hit me. Okay? But he concluded that people who survived were people who in that split second would respond with some sense of hope. And the people who died were the ones who responded with fear. Okay? So he concluded as an adult, when he was more formed in his study of this, that we die either literally or at least psychologically, we die if we live too long in fear. Okay? And so he said, in any community, people, if they've got any way out at all, they will eventually reject fear because they know that if they carry on along that way much longer, they're going to flatline. They're going to die psychologically, if not physically. The whole world has gone through and is still in this politics of fear. I mean, I believe that President Bush practiced it in the United States, but I believe that Premier Berlusconi practices it in Italy, and that the President of France is practicing it there right now.
I think we have gone through a paroxysm of fear for 20 or 30 years through much of the world. I believe that perhaps it is coming to an end, not because of any change among the people who are promoting fear, but because of a realization among us that we simply can't eat that food anymore. Okay? We're going to have to start pushing that food away from us at the table when it is offered to us by the servers. Okay? Because if we keep on eating that food, we're going to die psychologically, if not actually. And I think there is something in the spirit of man that knows that we cannot keep on eating that food any longer. And I think we're going to see people pushing the plate of fear away from them. You know, here and in other places, I think you're going to see it in political expressions, but I also think you're going to see it in corporate expressions. You know, I think you're going to see it in academic expressions. Because if there is fear, it is not unique and peculiar to the political environment. Fear is being fed to us almost everywhere we turn.
What makes you think that the change is coming? I guess I'm thinking of the last U.S. election. Last week it was depressing. I thought that change would be coming, but it doesn't seem to be. Or do you think it's just going to be slower?
Perhaps I can't do any better than fall back on "it's always darkest just before the dawn." I'm sorry. I don't think that there is any way you could point to evidence and say that is objective evidence that we are starting to push away the plates of fear. Okay? It is a sense I have in my gut, and in part, again, it is related to my faith convictions. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think God wants us to live in fear. Okay? We bring this on ourselves, and you read the Bible, you know, the Babylonian exile, you know, 40 years in the Sinai. God does not want this. And we get into situations where if reflection is forced on us, if we have the opportunity for reflection, the light bulb goes on. Unhappily for God, it doesn't stay on long enough in our heads. You know, but the light bulb does go on. So, Frankl makes sense to me. I read that years ago, and it made sense to me. And I relate it to what I see happening through much of the world. And I think that before our leaders know it, we will be pushing the plate away from ourselves because we have to. I think the leaders will be the last ones to follow us, or the last ones to understand. You know, and as I say, I believe that this is not at all peculiar to our political circumstances. I think we've got the same thing going on in our economy. I think we've got the same thing going on in our academic community, in many of our cultural communities. You know, it's endemic. One other thing, and I'm sort of getting, I'm going away from what David had in mind. A man named MacGregor Burns wrote a great book about leadership. Okay? And he said, we tend to think of the word as being the label for the characteristics of the man or the woman who's a leader. Okay? Kennedy is a leader, or Obama is a leader. He said, that's incorrect. Leadership is a label for the characteristics of the relationship that exists between the leader and the community. Okay? So, MacGregor Burns said, that we make progress by bouncing a beam of virtue back and forth, like that. Okay? Sometimes the leader is leading, and sometimes the leader is following. Okay? And he quotes Gandhi, who said, "Sometimes I lead, often I follow the people of India." Okay? And that too has really struck me. Clearly in my life, there have been times, maybe only moments, that I was a leader. There have been many, many, many times that I have learned from the people around me, and I've been far better by paying attention to the people around me than presuming that I've got it. Okay? And so, if we talk about pushing the plate of fear away from the table, okay, maybe that's the point at which this community, okay, leads, and our leaders have to learn from that. Obama's got a very complex situation. People think that when you're elected president of the United States, you personally are either going to do it or not. Okay? He has to make progress with an incredibly complex government system where people in the Senate, people in the House of Representatives, lobbyists have incredible influence. At a certain point, I start waving my arms around.
I've been in Turkey recently and had the privilege of developing a bit of a relationship with a foundation in Turkey that promotes the work of a particular Turkish theologian, Muslim theologian by the name of Said Nursi, who died in 1960. So I've been reading Nursi's work a bit, and in conversations with this movement, it's really a movement. I think it's an Islamic Renaissance movement. The one thing that is so immediately striking about it is that Said Nursi said that the way in which political Islam has made use of fear is a kind of blaspheme. And his own journey, I mean, he went through an extraordinary set of experiences, from prison in Russia when he was captured in the First World War, seeing the end of the Ottoman Empire, but then going into a kind of dark night of the soul, which lasted for several years. He withdrew to a cave. I mean, it sounds like something straight out of the Desert Fathers. But when he comes out of that, he has this very vivid sense that he no longer lives in the shadow of fear, or the shadow of fear is fruit, death.
Yeah.
He no longer lives in the shadow of death. And so, and seems really in his work, you know, this is always a little... perhaps a little dangerous to say, but certainly my sense from this enormous number of people that have been attracted to him, and particularly young people, one of the things that they've said over and over again, the young people, is that why they have come here is because it doesn't function like any of the other movements. And the key issue is fear. No fear. That's not the orientation.
Yeah.
But we have a very curious issue with political leaders around this as well, to try and find ways both to not accept what they offer, but to invite them to a different stance. And there is a challenge for us, how to invite them to a different stance. Some of you have heard me say this before, but I suspect that at the last civic election in Edmonton 4 or 5 years ago, there was a little cafe held at noon, and one of the people running for mayor came there, and you would know him, of course. And lovely person, And he gave his little talk for 20 minutes or so. Did the usual thing that people do in that when they're running for mayor. Talked about budgets, talked about moving a few numbers around here and there. And when he had finished, there were questions and what have you. And finally, I had about as much as I could take. And he recognized my hand. And so I said to him, you know, my sense is that if you're mayor, you're really an evangelist. There's a big breath that goes up in the everybody that's there. And that you've got some kind of gospel. You've got some kind of good news. I want to hear about the good news. I want to hear what your gospel is, because I know, as well as you, that it makes not one damn bit of difference whether you're elected mayor or whether somebody who's in the NDP is elected mayor. Because all you're going to be able to do is move some numbers around, 2 or 3 points this way, 2 or 3 points that way. If you're elected 3 times in a row, it'll make a difference, but it won't make any difference in the short term. But I'd like to know how you understand us here in Edmonton. What kind of what do you want to see when you finish your tenure? What do you want to see our relationships to look like? What would our relationship be like to each other, to the stranger, to the neighbor, to the friend? What is the gospel you have for us? What are you going to spend your time speaking about in terms of how we understand each other and how we ought to seek to live together? What would that look like? And I want you to speak about that without any reference to budget sheets, because they don't make a damn bit of difference. Now, there was a marked silence in the room. On the one hand, I think for many people, an aha moment, like maybe you can come at these things differently. In terms of the gentleman who was running for mayor, he took a long pause, and then he said, and I admire him for it, he said, "I'm sorry, but I have never thought of that." I said, "You've never thought that your position was a position where you had an opportunity to work with us around how we think about our life together, around how we think about the civil world together." He said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I have never thought about that. Maybe I could talk with you about it."
Yeah.
But I mean, it's that kind of, it's so thorough. I mean, that's what's so amazing about it. It's so thorough, this infection.
Oh, it really is. This is such an important point.
What was the phrase? Invite them to a different stance?
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that struck me was that when you attack something, you are giving it value.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Reinforcing.
If the people down here are trying to capture the castle, okay, it's because something about the castle has value. Okay? It controls the past, or the king is there, or fortune is there, or whatever else. Okay? When you are attacking the castle, right, what can you do except heighten the felt need to defend what is there? Right? There's nothing about attacking the castle that invites these people to leave the castle walls and go down into the valley, you know, down onto the plain. Okay? Inviting people to a different stance can't be accomplished by attacking the stance they've got. Psychologists would say that we live inside stories. Okay. Clergy would say that we live inside stories. Okay. And we do. And these are a combination. I guess I should finish that. These are a combination of values, and identity let me be personal, and I could just as easily choose another name as the premier's, okay? But we know him, okay? I don't think that there is anything in Mr. Stelmach's biography that suggests that he likes to be what political psychologists call the stern father. Okay? When you hear about his kids, when you hear about his relationship with his kids, okay, it doesn't, there's nothing there that strikes me that he wants to be the stern father. But that is what psychologists say is the role that he is playing as premier. Okay? He's making the tough decisions and imposing things on us that we need for our own good. Okay? So the stern father is a combination of values. He loves his kids, he feels compassion for his kids, and the list goes on. Okay? And I believe that of Mr. Stelmach. Okay? It's a combination of values and a felt need to play a certain role in order to protect those values or promote those values. Okay. Now, however it has happened, he is in a position of believing that he has to play out a certain role in order to promote certain values. If I had a conversation with Mr. Klein, you know, over a beer or a cup of coffee, I wouldn't be at all surprised that quite a number of his values might be my values, or vice versa.
You mean Mr. Stelmach or Mr. Klein?
I meant Mr. Stelmach. Sorry. I definitely
thought. The reason I know that is that you would never have a beer with Mr. Klein.
No, that's right. So to invite people to a different stance, okay, you've got to know what their values are. You've got to ask them questions. You've got to get to know them. You've got to understand that. Okay? And then you have to make a path for their identity to follow their values to some different place. You want to get them out of the castle and onto the plain. The Bible says, without vision, a people perish. We live inside stories. Stories require us to be very careful about our language. One of the problems is that stories come to be vacuous when we're casual about the language that we use in telling the story. And sometimes this is why the three-year-old child demands that you tell the story of Cinderella using exactly the same words that you used last night, or the night before, or the week before. Okay. The words are very important, and we tend to be casual about words. Oh, I can say this, or I can say that, it doesn't matter. Words build the story. The story builds the way that a person can get out of here and move. But that's what we need to do. Whether it is in politics or in faith or in our business world, if we're working at Walmart or wherever we are working, okay, yes, I want to contend with this. I don't want the fortified hill, the fort on the hill, okay? But I've got to be careful about thinking through how to get these people to come out of the fort. And it is a different proposition than attacking them.
You mentioned the whatever is it, the three language or whatever?
Yes.
And the party discipline. So it seems very difficult, even in conversation with one's MLA, if they are under that discipline.
Yes.
They only have to spout off what the party says about this. I mean, it's very similar to most letters. You know, you write a letter and then you get a response, which is, well, first of all, it's generic usually. But
but it is, okay, it's simply what the party line is. So how does one move, you know, so, you know, most of us know our MLAs because they're, you know, whatever, one of them was a prof here, or whatever. That's like, we know them personally and socially, but as soon as we go into the constituency office, it seems to click over, and then we only hear whatever the official stance is. So it seems very hard to move. And with some of them, yeah, we've had enough conversation that we have a sense of their values, et cetera, et cetera, but we can't shift. It's very hard to invite into something else. So I don't know how one goes about it.
One of the practical matters, which is very easy to state and very difficult to accomplish, because, again, we've fallen into it in many, many places. Okay? In my view, the government caucus has made a mistake, but so have many municipal councils and so have many school boards, in that they have come to a point of saying that all of our discussion is privileged and we've got to have discipline not only after a decision is made, but before a decision is made. Okay? At least in our political realm, okay, the model should be that people speak freely until the decision is made. Okay? Your MLA should be able to tell you what is his or her predisposition about expanding the hospital, paving the road, or anything else. It should not be, you tell me what you think, I will not respond, I'll go to caucus, I'll hear everything that is said around the caucus table, and we'll make a decision there. So, all of us, no matter which constituency we live in, no matter who our MLA is, when we write letters to the editor, when we do phone-in shows or whatever else, we should be promoting the idea that we expect our MLAs to be open to us until the decision is made. When a corporate decision is made, school council, municipal council, the legislative assembly, unless it is a morally defining issue that would cause you to resign, I think from that point on, it is reasonable to say this was an issue in which many minds were at work. I carried one view to the table, but the majority of people had a different view, and the decision is made. Like everybody else, I will do my best to make that decision successful. Okay? I mean, who knows if you should enlarge the hospital or pave that highway? To me, if everybody else says do it and my position has been no, I am prepared to say when that decision is made, I'll do my best to make the collective decision successful. Okay? But before that decision is made, whether I live in Iris's constituency or you live in Verlin's constituency, we should all be saying to our MLAs every time we see them that our expectation is that they will be frank with us about where they are with information and perspective at this moment in time. And maybe if I see them a week later, it will be somewhat different because in the intervening week, they may have talked to 10 other people who have given them more knowledge. But we have throttled our process by acceding to this claim that their only role is to listen to us, not to respond, and then go behind closed doors and make a decision there, the nature of which we know not.
One of the tragedies of this, it seems to me, is that we've also created a kind of culture in which we're no longer very tolerant of the difficulties of political decision, and we also aren't very patient. So if you look at the American election just recently, one of the things that's so striking to me about it, I know a number of people that live in the States, and I've talked with them about it, who are on the far left. You know, they make Obama look like he's, you know, a bit on the right. But their lack of patience with Obama was startling to me. It's And it makes me think that they really, in the end, are utopian. They think these things can happen quickly. Now, it doesn't mean they shouldn't be critical and what have you, but I think that the process you described here has functioned within the general population as well to really atrophy our capacity to hold difference together at all levels, including differences in political opinion, and to work towards things in the long run.
Oh, I think that's right. Very interesting book of 3 or 4 years ago called The Wisdom of Crowds. Won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. And the writer said that there are three kinds of questions about which experts give us very little help. He said there are three kinds of questions where the crowd will make a better decision than the expert most times. Okay? The crowd being the public, us around this table, you know, 12 people who are our board of directors, whatever. And I would call those three kinds of questions political questions. Okay? He called them questions of cognition. Okay. How can we know who is going to win the Grey Cup? Okay. Or it might equally be, how can we know that paving that secondary road is a good thing? Okay. This is about something that will unfold in the future, okay, that we will know about in the future, but we can't know it right now. Okay. Problems of cognition. He said the other kinds of problems are problems of cooperation. Okay, what should we do together? What should we leave to other people to do? And problems of coordination. How can you get as many people as possible from east to west through Edmonton? Okay, how many roads do you build, or build what? So he said there are three kinds of problems that groups will do better with than individuals with, provided four conditions are met. One of them is that it has to be a diverse group, including some people who are ignorant about the issue. They'll ask the questions that need to be asked. Okay. Secondly, he says there has to be a high degree of trust so that people will disclose private information. When you're talking to Verlin, will you tell him something that you know about the future of the nursing home that he would not otherwise know? Okay. The third thing he said is that we have to have a variety of different ways of measuring our outcome. It shouldn't always be a vote with a plurality. Sometimes we might say we need a consensus or whatever else. And fourthly, he said the people who are involved in making the decision have to have a significant role in implementing it. Okay? But if those conditions are met, there are all kinds of decisions, okay, where the crowd should be invited into the decision-making process. Okay? And one of the conditions, which goes back to caucus versus his conversation with you, okay, is that there has to be diverse input and a high degree of trust so that diverse people will share private knowledge. They're cutting themselves off from that when they do what they are doing at the present time.
Well, thank you so much.
We sort of wandered far afield,
didn't we,
David?
Yeah, lovely to walk those paths with you. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.